It's so hard to convert your own heart over and over and over again. And if you're not in a healthy community that supports you in that journey and is full of people committed to that together, it's going to go south so quickly.
Welcome back to Religion to Reality, where this week we're going to be talking about community and the role it can play in our faith formation. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and I'm joined, as always, by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowich. In our discipleship study and across a lot of these conversations we've been having as a part of this project, community is one of those recurring themes that keeps coming up. People involved in faith groups more frequently cited community than discussion or learning as the best feature of being involved. And the people that aren't involved in some kind of community express a pretty strong interest in getting involved. John, you are a pretty involved guy in general. I would say that you're very active in a number of communities. Are there anything that stands out to you as of late?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you're right. It is kind of fun for me to be involved in lots of different communities. And I always look at community as a way to kind of help me to better myself, to maybe discover the things that I don't even know about who I am.
Just kind of using people like a network group style.
I just use people left and right. Yeah, that's all I do. But I mean, like, you know, we are just relational beings, right? So that's just what we are. So that's exactly how we are able to come to discover who we are by our encounters, and how attentive we are to those encounters. We can come out of ourselves and then become a gift to those in our midst.
Yeah. Something that's been on my mind is how hard I feel like my wife and I have struggled to be in community with other Catholics, other Christians, in kind of our journey. And I just wonder if there are certain areas that don't have a lot to offer when it comes to community, or is it the fact that is it how one is approaching community that's really maybe the hang up, you know? Is it such that, you know, certain communities just are stronger, or are those people just better at doing community? And that's really what gives it its strength. Nothing to do with, you know, like the topic or what they do or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think it's a lot of things. I think that community always emerges when people realize that they need it. So I think that's just basically it. If people don't feel like they need it for some reason, as hard as they try to make something happen, I don't think something will happen. But, you know, you just think about all the communities that emerge over like a certain type of interest or a certain type of passion. I think people feel as if somehow being connected to other like-minded people kind of augments the whole experience of whatever it is that they're into. I mean, you just think about like, well, I was just watching that documentary on the Grateful Dead and all that, and like that community that emerged around that band. But you could say the same thing about Taylor Swift and so many other like popular figures like that. There's some type of real need to kind of extend the just the passion, the excitement that something's happened. So I think, you know, in the faith space, when people have a genuine encounter with God in some way, they've met Jesus as a real person, I think that they start to want to find people who've had similar types of experiences to like augment the experience. So I think something like that might happen. So when people need it, that's when it seems to emerge.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, for this episode, we spoke with three guests who are all involved in very different forms of community. First up, we spoke with Dr. Mark Heyman, who I met in the Scent community, which is a Catholic entrepreneurship group that we were in for a year together. Mark is a licensed psychologist and host of the Whiskey and the Word small group at St. Bridget Parish in San Diego. They're a group that meets regularly for fellowship and discussion over a glass of whiskey. And by the way, it's not at the parish, it's in his backyard. We'll hear a little bit about how they spread and how not every group can be for every person.
Is there a format of some sort, or how do you get the conversation going, or like, what does that look like?
Yeah, so by definition or by design, there's really no format besides what we kind of the general structure is we meet at 7 o'clock the first and third Wednesday of the month in my backyard. So it's the same place every week, whether I'm in town or not. And there have been times when I've been on vacation and I left a key for someone and they've gone into my house and gotten the whiskey cart, because we have a whiskey cart where we have all of our whiskey for the group. People show up about 7 o'clock. They pour themselves a glass of whiskey from the cart. And every week somebody brings a we ask someone to bring a bottle. So we have one new bottle at least per week. So we'll just sit around and talk for the first 45 minutes or so. Sometimes someone has something on their mind, they're having trouble in their marriage or with their kids or with their family that they want to talk about and got to get the group's feedback about. Oftentimes it's just, how's life and what's going on? And usually the conversation goes from there. As the group leader, I always have something in my back pocket to ask. I'm always reading and listening and talking, thinking about, what would be a fruitful conversation tonight if nothing else comes up. But that's very rarely the case where we have, silence or no topic that no topic brought up by the group. And then about halfway through the meeting, we open the new bottle and we do a blind tasting. So we, pass the bottle around and everyone pours themselves a small glass and we have a discussion about the whiskey. If the person who brought the bottle knows anything about what they brought, they'll talk about the story behind the whiskey and really kind of understand that. And then usually about 8:15 or 8:30, we'll shift to the word where we'll read the upcoming readings for the next Sunday. So whether it's just the gospel or whether it's all three readings and have a discussion there. I would say that about, we probably do that about half the time where we actually get to the word. And the other half, we just, because the conversation is flowing and there's no, it's fruitful, we don't find a need to stop and actually, have that delineation where we focus on the word because really we're there for fellowship. And invariably the conversation is always around faith in some way, whether it's direct or tangential.
So it started with some guys that you knew from the parish. Has it grown outside of the parish now, or is it mostly guys from the parish? What's the membership look like?
Yeah, it's about half and half. So I would say that probably about half the guys who come regularly are parishioners that are at St. Bridget, and about half of the guys are from other places. They knew someone from St. Bridget who invited them, or they used to be a parishioner and then they moved out of the parish bounds or now going to a different church. But it's really a mix of, certainly the core of the group is St. Bridget, but certainly everyone is welcome. And even we have quite a few people who are either not Catholic who are interested or and quite a few recent converts. So people have gone through OCIA recently and then and are now Catholic and really want to have that fellowship that they had not ever had never had before.
So it's rare that someone's hearing the word for the first time at these meetings.
It's rare, yes. But it has happened before. And I think that the great thing about this type of group is that whiskey really kind of breaks all barriers. And I don't mean that in any kind of social lubrication way. I just mean in the sense that we have guys who come and they'll sit. We sit in a circle, so they can't really sit in the corner, but they'll sit there and they'll just sip on their whiskey and listen and won't say a word throughout the evening. And that's totally fine. No one's gonna ever put them on the spot or ask them to share their deepest, darkest secrets. That's not our goal, actually, very opposite of our goal. Our goal is to be, if people want to talk, then they are welcome to. If people don't want to talk, that's fine as well. But what invariably happens is they'll come a couple of times and I'll just sit there. And then all of a sudden, one day they'll just open up and become a central part of the conversation. So we find that kind of that observation period, people want to take that, is a great way to make people feel comfortable. One thing that I've experienced that's really turned me off in the past is going on retreats or being part of groups where there's forced sharing or forced conversation, either by questions or like going around a group and saying, "What do you think? What do you think?" And it really makes me uncomfortable. And so I'm very intentional, unless I know somebody and I know them well, to be able to ask them a question and direct the conversation towards them. I'm very careful not to do that because I want to make sure people are feeling welcome and that that we're growing our fellowship organically, as opposed to making it some sort of forced or contrived fellowship that which again, from my personal experience, has been a real big turnoff.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I'm not a fan of that kind of group share either, even though I'm in the business of trying to facilitate those things in so many different ways. As a teacher, so many times you're just like, you just want students to talk, right? I mean, so you're trying to do whatever you can to kind of encourage that. But yeah, there's something there where you're trying to always you want to create the the small group feel, but you don't want it to become somehow like burdensome where people feel like the pressure that they have to respond or have to somehow participate in a particular way. So I really can see the wisdom in what you're doing. Now, one thing I have also done as a teacher, you know, I really enjoy being part of the community of with the staff and the faculty. And so, you know, I'm one of the people who regularly organizes our Friday happy hour. And that's a great time. And it's kind of similar. It's just fellowship and conversations go wherever they need to go. Maybe it's clearly not as pointed and intentional as what you're doing. But, you know, the where I run into some issues, and legitimately so, is that people are like, well, this is only for people who like to drink. And so we've already kind of excluded so many people because, and I'm always working painlessly, like I'm like, no, you don't have to drink to be part of this. There's pizza there. You can just have water and soda. It's totally fine. No one is judging anyone for drinking or not. Has that been any type of, have you had any pushback in that regard? Because it is a legitimate concern. So could you just speak of that? Is that something?
Yeah, for sure. So a couple of things. So yes, I have had pushback for sure. And my response to that quite honestly is if alcohol is an issue for you, either because you have an addiction or because of something else, maybe this group isn't the best for you. And, you know, because I'm very intentional about making sure that we're forming communities in a way that certainly is inclusive, but also, you know, inviting and making sure that people are getting what they need. So there are some people, you know, Dave, you know, a mutual friend of ours, Scott Wieman, who's the CEO of Catholic in Recovery. You know, he's a former parishioner at my parish, and you know, he was certainly always invited to the group, but he never came because it was a group focused on alcohol, and that's not something for him. We've had people decline coming because they're in recovery and whatnot, and you know, and that's fine. And from my perspective, you know, certainly we don't want to be excluded, but you know, this is the kind of the core of the group and what our ethos is. Not around drinking, but certainly making whiskey a part and appreciation of whiskey a part of it. That being said, many of us during the year fast from alcohol for various reasons, primarily during Lent, or you know, many of us are part of a group that does Exodus 90, and during those times, you know, we just don't drink, or certainly individuals in the group don't drink. There have been people who have come who don't drink and just they'll bring a soda or they'll bring water and be part of the group. And while whiskey is certainly a integral part of the social fabric of the group, if you weren't drinking, you wouldn't feel left out because no one would really know. I mean, no one's actually looking and watching what anyone's drinking and that part. So it's been an interesting rub. Because we don't want to exclude, but we also want to make sure that this is a group of people with common interests, both faith interests, but also, you know, whiskey and cigars and other types of cardinal interests. And for some people, that's just not a good fit. Just like it wouldn't be a good fit if you wanted a very structured Bible study. I look at it the same way. You know, we've had people who have wondered why we're not doing, you know, having this, you know, okay, at 7 o'clock we do this, and at 7:15 we move this, and everyone shares their experiences in a circle. And just like that's not the ethos of our group, you know, being teetotalers is also not the ethos of our group. I know that's not an answer that some people will like, but I think it's what worked for us, and it's really what's helped us to build this community, and it's been very successful.
Every group can't be all things to all people. I think that's something that's good to explore, to understand that, because it can happen on a parish level. I mean, parishes try to be all things to all people, but sometimes it just doesn't work. I mean, sometimes there's just something about the ethos of the parish that's just not going to feed a person spiritually.
Yeah, that's a really interesting place to end there, John, because I went through, you know, just to make it personal, I went through a period with Susie where we were looking around for parishes. We were parish shopping for, I don't know, almost 2 years, I think, while we were trying to discern, like, where is this community that's going to feed us spiritually, like you said. At the end of all of that, we sort of ended up right back where we started, partly because the reality of having a kid is just like, okay, well, driving more than to the closest parish is just like,
really difficult right now. But also that's like, it's where we have our relationships, you know, and what else is community besides a series of relationships with the people that, you know, you want to be walking with. And so we kind of realized, you know what, like this may not be a place with the best homilies or the best music or whatever else, you know, and I'm not saying those things are always a problem either, but it's just trying to kind of optimize sort of the liturgy or the Catholic experience or whatever. It just left us realizing like, maybe it's us. And that's what I was trying to hint at before, is like, maybe what we're really called to do in community is kind of accept whatever it is that we don't like about the place and still find it somewhere that we can be fed.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. And because underlying that is the understanding that, first off, in any situation, God shows up. In any situation, you're going to be taken by surprise on the movement of the Spirit and how it just enlightens you and brings you into a new way of just, if anything, seeing the world or seeing your life. So, and especially if, even in the worst situations, wherever that would, however we define the worst situations, I mean, at the heart of the liturgy, we are having two or three gathered in the name of Jesus himself. So like something has to happen there, right? I do think that for when you're on a certain part of your faith journey, I think there is room to explore and try to find those things that seem to kind of feed a particular need you have on the faith journey. But I think by default, if that's the right way of saying it, any parish is going to be a place where you're going to encounter God in some level. And if you're always going to a place and you're getting frustrated because you don't like it for whatever reason, well, that's just something that I think you do have to kind of examine and work through. That doesn't excuse, like, you know, bad teaching, liturgy, heresy, you know, or anything like that. It's trying to really actively discern, like what is it that's really essential, what is it that's not really essential, and try to be honest with yourself with that.
And then the other thing that sticks out to me from the conversation with Mark is also kind of resonating with something that you said at the top, which was just that like group community happens when people need a particular type of community, right? It has to be an organic thing or else it's not really going to work. And that is so true. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's like, in my own life, I've failed to kind of create groups. I wasn't trying to do what Mark was trying to do exactly, or not even really that close. But the reality is, like, I'm interested in talking about faith with people who don't share my faith background or even my interest in faith. And so trying to create a faith group with someone who doesn't really want to talk about faith isn't really going to work for them. You know, it works for me, but it doesn't work for them. And it's just not getting started. And the other thing is, it's like, it's hard to find. Yeah, so I would be interested in starting a group, even with people who are interested in talking about faith. But so far, I haven't been able to find the people who want to have the conversations I want to have in my area. And so just trying to figure out where those people are exactly has been a real challenge. And I'm starting to think that maybe interfaith groups are maybe like kind of the place to sort of find what I'm looking to explore, which doesn't necessarily have to do specifically with Catholicism or even Christianity, but just like, you know, the path that we're really all on, if we're honest with ourselves.
Well, I definitely think that there is a very large segment of the population that is in some type of what is commonly called now interspiritual type of place, where they are pulling from lots of different traditions. They're seeing certain benefits here. They're leaving things that they learned in the past behind. Like there is a very strong emerging group right there. And I don't think that all of them are necessarily going to land at like a Catholic parish, but I think that's the group of people that you probably find the most, you know, resonance with, because those are really genuine seekers. And they're also people who can see the good and bad in situations and try to bring a level of discernment to things. So I think that is a real untapped group that has not been mobilized, if that's the right way to say it. That really requires a lot of effort to let go of the tribal nature of community, where we're thinking, well, this community is only legitimate if it fits into all the parameters of you know, Catholic teaching or doctrine or something like that. I mean, and I think, you know, he kind of gets a little bit at this in what he was saying about how, like, yeah, you know, you don't have to drink to be part of this. You can still very much be okay with drinking whatever and still feeling very, being very much part of the group. I think that he's onto something there. I don't know how well it works. I don't know. But I mean, that is a good way to enter into it, because there seems to be a pretty low bar of entry, and that's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, I know, Mark, I know they would be doing this responsibly. Like, so I can tell you, I haven't been, but I can pretty much guarantee that this is not a place where everyone's getting wasted, because nobody wants to be the only sober person in a situation. That's terrible. I don't think that's what's happening. Well, we talked a little bit about being involved in community, but living in community can be an entirely different experience. We spoke with Brené Rodin, who we heard from two episodes ago on the Expressive Fruits episode. She's a journalist and author who has been involved in the Catholic worker movement, currently living in a Catholic worker house. Father John had the chance to sit down with Brené and talk about the realities and difficulties of community life.
I'm talking more about the community itself, creating a society out of the shell of something old to create something new. You know, like, tell me a little bit more about your experience with that, because people could be very inspired to be like, all right, I'm going to, like, and, you know, I've had my own experience. I'm going to go run off to this monastery. I'm going to run off to this community. I'm going to do these things here, because, like, this is where people are getting it right. And then you quickly realize, like, oh, it's not as good as I thought it was, or I'm not committed to it, I guess, in the way that I thought I could have been. So, like, could you just talk a little bit about your experience with community in within the context of the Catholic worker and what that really ultimately means within
the church? I think, yes. So, one, I remember talking to a Benedictine monk about struggles I was having in a community. And he said, oh, well, yeah, community life is hard. And I was like, yes, it is. However, you have a 1300-year-old rule that guides you, and you have 2 years of, you know, novitiate to understand that rule, plus, you know, an abbot. Like, you have a lot of structures you've agreed upon about what it means to be a monk in that community that can at least, they're guardrails, you know, they're there's something to hold on to as you navigate that difficult sort of communal life together. I think the problem in a lot of Catholic worker communities is very simple, which is just that there's not enough clarification of thought of what it means to even be a Catholic worker, what the goals are. And those are very basic things you have to answer in order to function together as a community. So I actually think this is not original to me. There are other people in the movement who had this insight, but I've come to agree with them, is that the Catholic worker movement seems to be thriving in many ways amongst families, right? And so I've met many families who have decided, you know, they've read Dorothy and Peter's work and they say, oh, we can practice this in our household. I know one family that has four children, and, you know, whenever they decide to take in a guest, they like move all the kids, they kind of rearrange their house to create a guest suite for the guests that they will take in off the street, or that a shelter will call them for overflow. So they're very committed to that radical vision. And I do think there's a natural stability to family life. You know, like, I think intimacy is a really foundational key for a community. It gets lost, but you need intimacy. You need friendship. You need to feel like you're seen. And so, you know, within a marriage, hopefully you have that between a husband and a wife, naturally, that commitment of like, okay, the goal of all this, kind of like the Eucharist, right? The goal of all of whatever we're doing is ultimately just for us to love each other better so that we can love God better, you know, and that need to know and love and see the other person is so central to what a marriage and a family is, that it's a solid basis for a community, which you're not always guaranteed to have at a lot of the countercultural communes that Jenny O'Dell brings up. I thought her insight is, I just find it so wise. You know, she talks about how so many communes end in disaster and in, like, you know, the genius who wants to escape the capitalist system said it, you know, he becomes his own dictator. And I think you see that, you do see that in a lot of countercultural communes, unfortunately. But I also think the reason that is because that's the temptation of all our own hearts, you know, and it's really hard to It's so hard to convert your own heart over and over and over again. And if you're not in a healthy community that supports you in that journey and is full of people committed to that together, it's going to go south so quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that's a marriage, a monastery, a Catholic worker community, like it takes a lot of personal accountability. I do think that the Catholic worker is a very practical vision, but I think one of the wisdoms that I feel like I've learned is that if you want to start a Catholic worker, you should first comes your friends, you know, first comes the people that you know. I know some friends in North Carolina who started their kind of Catholic worker community. You know, they were just all friends and they sat and read a Catholic worker book together and then they read another one, you know, so it kind of began with friends who all were longing for the same thing. And I think that's a very necessary component. I think also I would say community, I've come to see community much more about me and my neighbors versus like who I share a household with on some level. Mm-hmm. Or I think that's the more important community to focus on for a Catholic worker. Like you might think, oh, I'm not a Catholic worker. I don't live with 10 other people. That doesn't mean anything. You know, like you can live in an apartment alone, but if you are practicing hospitality as much as you can, you know, trying to organize with your neighbors, having these clarification with thoughts of friends, trying to create that community, even if you don't all share the same roof, I think that's very much in the organizing spirit of the Catholic worker.
Yeah. And maybe as we're kind of winding down, let's talk a little bit about some of the more difficult or controversial aspects of the Catholic worker movement. There's a lot of younger people, let's say, who find Dorothy Day in some way. They read her Long Loneliness autobiography, or they're introduced to her in some capacity and they get really excited. And then they try to find a Catholic worker house that they can say, oh, well, let's see how this is all lived. So they, you know, they're all excited and they go to try to find a community and they're quickly disheartening because in the community, they feel like, well, the brand of Catholicism that I grew up on, which was very, let's say, mass centric, sacramentally driven, that doesn't seem to be part of the community. So like, how do Catholic workers negotiate through all these different types of Catholic workers who have all different types of things of, say, Dorothy and Peter's vision that they latch onto? And some of the more explicitly Catholic things that people would say are like connected to doctrine, dogma, sacraments, rituals, those things are not necessarily something that they're in for. So like, what could you tell someone who's, you know, disillusioned by that?
I really haven't personally had that experience, but yes, I have talked to people who've had that experience. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I've noticed is that young people go on to create their own houses, right? Mm-hmm. They find a mm-hmm. like-minded person, whether that's a friend, a romantic partner, and they create their own houses. And I've seen some of the most creative Catholic worker houses that I admire that I feel like have a fresh new vision are completely committed Catholics. They have a beautiful liturgical life and they, yeah, have a lot of energy, right? They're a bunch of young people, kind of like those first Catholic workers in New York. They have a lot of energy and they're on fire. And so I think I would, you know, kind of advise someone to look for that kind of community if that's what they're looking for. They're easy to find online at the Catholic Worker website. I also think, you know, talking to people who've been in more difficult community situations, you know, the beauty of the Catholic Worker is that it's just a space of radical welcome. There's always asterisks because we're imperfect humans, so it may not always feel that way to people, especially if you live here. But yeah, they are spaces of radical welcome. They're so rare and they draw a lot of people who've never felt belonging anywhere else mm-hmm. and did, whether by the church, by society, like you name it, right? So they draw a bunch of like very wounded people to them a lot of time. Mm-hmm. I think they're often so engaged in healing and responding to the immediate needs of people outside their community there's often not a lot of energy or time to like heal one another in the community. So I think that that can sometimes lead to those dysfunctions. And what's always really interesting is I think even if folks in the house have had a bad experience with church or are no longer interested in participating in that life, I always find that people at churches are often very interested in getting to know the worker. So that can also be like a helpful infusion of life and energy and hope of inviting, you know, folks from your parish to come over. And I think that can sometimes, yeah, create, it won't often heal wounds or heal divisions, but it can, you know, create this new sense of positive engagement with the church. I remember one of our parishioners who helped run the food pantry in Chicago. You know, she had a lot of questions about the Catholic worker because she was very confused because she remembered the Catholic worker. I can't remember what they were doing. There was some like pro-life or pro-choice rally, and they were, she remembers them like not reflecting the church's message on it. So she was very confused what the Catholic worker was. And I think that's where, you know, we would just explain who Dorothy was and kind of the original vision of the Catholic worker, and that it is anarchist, and people apply this message in lots of different ways that some ways people would describe as unorthodox, some as orthodox. And so really it's important to just kind of look around and find the community that you feel like represents your Catholic faith. But also I think there's an invitation to dialogue. You know, Catholic workers are Americans just like anyone else. So they're not always the best at dialogue, but like, I think that's also, I feel like what we're called to do is to try to like Catholic worker tradition of clarification of thought of like, okay, why do you think this way? Why do you feel this way? That's really hard to do in community when you're living on top of each other as well, to have that space to encounter the other person as a person and say, well, why do you want to do it this way? Or why do you think this way about the church?
I just think about how, you know, how much of community is contingent upon clarification of terms, so to speak, right? Like, what is it that this community espouses? What does it believe? What's its mission? Clearly, in the Catholic space, there we have creeds and we have other things that kind of make it very clear as to what the ideal is for everyone to hold to. Any good community can only function in as much as how many people within it adhere to, let's say, the law or the constitutions that are that oversee it. So that's really interesting because we don't necessarily approach the desire for community with the desire to follow a rule, so to speak. I mean, some people do, clearly. I'm not saying that's not. But that's an interesting type of tension. I think there's, because a lot of people just want to be accepted for where they are, who they are, what they think, what they believe. And if you have certain types of viewpoints that don't seem to kind of reflect what the community has already determined to be the viewpoint, so to speak, that's a very tenuous place to be.
Yeah. I mean, I think the clarification of purpose of a group is important, but I don't think it always needs to be explicit. Is maybe the way I'd say that. So, you know, the first communities that we're a part of are like just our friends growing up, right? Very few friends growing up will ever kind of call a little meeting to order and be like, all right, guys, what are we actually doing here? Like, why are we playing video games today anyway? You know, but I think there's a little bit of that in like any organic group that continues, like no matter how old we are, right? That you and I, John, are in what I would call an ongoing small group with another friend of ours. Right. And we have weekly conversations every week, every year, ongoing. And we have never had, like, we've never had to have a conversation where we're like, why do we do this? Like, what's the purpose of this? We just know. Right. We know why we do it. We never had to say so. Right.
Right.
But it is purposeful. Like, if it wasn't, for sure, our other friend would be out of there. I think it needs to be present. Like, the purpose needs to be present, but not necessarily explicitly there. The other things that Renee was talking about was the kind of themes of successful community is both stability and intimacy. And she even kind of ended by saying, like, but not too much intimacy. You can't be living on top of each other, right? Like, you need, like, everybody needs their own space.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not free intimacy. It's forced intimacy somehow. I like that because it was resonant with what Mark was talking about with his group, right? His group, you know, he says, we always meet at the same time every week, even if I'm not even home. Like, it's always going to be in my backyard, same day of the week, every week. And they sit in such a way where no one is excluded. There's no corner that you can go hide in. So you know, even if you are just a listener, you're right in there with everybody else. So I think there is this kind of like intimacy there. And then, of course, the other aspect specifically of the Catholic worker is this radical welcome, which I think what I heard Renee calling us to do is each of us to think about how we can live that radical welcome, even if we're never going to be living in a Catholic worker house or something like that. What does that look like in our own lives?
Yeah, definitely. Radical welcome. That's a great way of saying it. I mean, it's hard, right? Because it requires trust. And that's like seems to be the thing that we aren't talking about here yet, is that trust is essential in order for a community to succeed. And it's essential for someone to enter into it. Like, you have to be willing to trust that the community is going to accept you where you are and going to walk with you where you, let's just say, where you want to go. I think we have an epidemic, is that the right word, for lack of trust in our society. And I think that that's maybe why community flounders a lot.
Agreed. The other thing I was picking up on that she was talking about is that the purpose ultimately of community is conversion of heart. And she was saying, part of the point of being in community is that you're not going to be able to do that for yourself all the time. That she was talking about, like, the leader of these new groups become dictators of their own lives, you know, chasing some kind of temptation that's not really what God's vision for our lives is necessarily. And, you know, we talked about how, you know, can't do that. That's why Exodus 90 guys are in a group. I think we mentioned that in an episode before. And it's also why we talked to Dr. Bill Kleimig from Franciscan University of Steubenville's Catechetical Institute. And I remember him telling me the critical aspect of everything is not actually all the modules that they've created for all these different types of formation, but it's the fact that they recommend doing it in small groups. And he says specifically small groups of three or four, because you want it to be intimate but be big enough that there is some kind of like discussion happening. He said, like, you know, every once in a while there's an outlier. You know, he said that he talked about this nun in Taipei who just like plows through this stuff all on her own. She's just like amazing. Like, it's just kind of, but she's just somehow driven internally to do this, but that's extremely rare. That most people need other people to go through it with them.
Yeah, I mean, like, the smaller the better, I think, always works in being able to kind of cultivate that intimacy. I mean, and it's really, and you know, it's antithetical to so much of how we think, as maybe as Americans or Westerners, where, you know, the bigger the better, the more the merrier, all those types of ways. Like, we just need to kind of make the biggest impact because we come to it with such utilitarian values, but the smaller, the better. That's how it always is.
Right. There's also the idea of how we even define community in the first place, especially with more people talking online and connecting online than ever before. So to go into this a little bit more, I spoke with one of my coworkers from DeSales Media, Luisa Maria Hernandez. In addition to her role here as a success and solutions consultant, Luisa Maria has been involved in many different Catholic communities over the years. We spoke about the nature and role of digital communities compared to traditional in-person groups. Is it the case that the best way that digital serves community is by helping people to find out about communities and lead them into in-person communities? Or is it totally reasonable for certain communities to just stay digital and people meet online and that's that?
I think it should be used as kind of an entry point, right? It gets you knowing what's happening. People don't know what they don't know. So I think that it's maybe the first option, right? Where people are getting to know what's happening, getting to know what's available to them. And then that leads to that in person. Sometimes, again, right, you might be in different places around the world, but or even the country, and you might not be able to meet in person. But I think my hope with the development of digital ministry and communications is that people will be empowered and encouraged to say, we've been meeting online, now let's meet in person.
Right.
And that even if that in-person connection doesn't happen within the group or community that you're a part of, it'll inspire you to either start your own community or be part of a community that's already in existence. Because you might have something right in your backyard that's really close to what you're seeking online. Mm-hmm. You haven't branched out, or their communications aren't great, and so you don't even know that it exists.
I think that the desire to meet in, so let's say a group mostly meets online or only meets online. I think the desire to meet up in person is a sign of a healthy group. You know, I lead a book club that is a Zoom-based book club, loosely based in Brooklyn. Actually, it's something that Father John here started during COVID. You know, that was the need. The thought was like, what can we do that would appeal to these particular people in a time that people can't get together in person? But since then, you know, it's been going, let's say 5 years, and we try to get together one or two times a year. Even though people are coming from different places, you know, I don't live in the city anymore, but we make it happen because we want to be in each other's presence, you know? And I think there's a yearning there. Similarly with the attentive heart work and the work that you're doing in Called with Sunday to Sunday, John, you know, that started as an online cohort of people journeying together and has now had an in-person retreat component that I think was beautiful. And people were really looking forward to, you know, spending the time in person because they love spending the time with each other in digitally. So why wouldn't they want to be in person and kind of meet, you know, actually coast to coast in that case?
Yeah, you know, I have found that it's almost like, you know, we've had like online dating for some time. And I have not done online dating myself, but what I actually gather from it is the fact that, like, you know, you really go through certain dimensions of your experience with the person online. And it kind of, in a certain sense, vets things out and kind of sees things where they are. And you go to a particular level in that context, so that when you actually have the in-person encounter, it's actually even more, it's a richer experience, because there's been more of an anticipation, there's been more groundwork that's been laid down that maybe could not have been done if you actually met the person in person up front. So, like, I feel that there's something else closer. Like, I think every time that we got together in person, whether it was a book club or there was a real genuine excitement to, like, actually see people in person for the first time, because there's just been so much developed with the relationship virtually. So I have found that to be a really good part of the whole, like, virtual experience leading up to the in-person. That makes sense.
Right? Like, that anticipation, I think, is so close to what we experience as Christians. And even with, I mean, as Catholics, right, there's a calendar of the readings, right, and what we're experiencing in the Mass. And I think that anticipation is so connected to what we experience when we're in these online communities, where we know what's going to happen next, which is what we hope for, right? We want these virtual encounters to be in person. We want the scripture to lead to this specific outcome. And I think it's all connected. We have to want to see things in that way. But it's exciting. I think it's this continuous promise of, like, you're committed, you're going to show up every Tuesday at 7 PM, you know, whatever time zone you're in, and you're going to meet with these people. But at the end of it, like, something really great is going to happen, hopefully. Right.
You use the word commitment. And that is the key to me for community, and something that I have a hard time in my own life, you know, accepting a lot of the time. I think it's one of the reasons it's been so difficult for my wife and I to find a parish community. Not that there's a fear of commitment per se, but that there's a desire to find the perfect parish community. You know, that's firing on all cylinders and all that kind of stuff, rather than just going to just realize, like, you know what, like, there's always going to be something lacking in some way, or maybe that's even the wrong way to look at it. Like, maybe this isn't a moment to be critical. Maybe it's a moment to be accepting, looking at ourselves, say, like, wow, like, why is this so important for us to kind of be in control? Let us rather, like, enter into this space, recognizing, like, we're not in control of these other people, and yet we still want to commit to kind of journeying with them, you know, spiritually.
I think that commitment will lead to consistency, right? And so if you have that consistency, you're going to want you're going to naturally be more committed. And I mean, I've had experiences within different ministries that I've been a part of and groups and things where it's kind of developed, and it develops with you and with the parts of your life that are changing. And I mean, I was one of the co-leaders for the Young Professional Women's Group at the Harvard Catholic Center for 5 years. And over those 5 years, it started with, we're meeting every week and we're going to see each other, and this is the time to, hey, maybe it's once a month, or during the pandemic, hey, it's over Zoom and this is what it's going to be. And consistently, I was there. I was showing up, right? It's not that I didn't have a choice, but I was one of the people running it. So I needed to be there. And the thing that people would ask throughout those 5 years all the time was consistency. If we're there consistently, and if we know when it's going to happen, then I will be able to commit. Structure would lead to clarity, right? And that structure within that led to the clarity of recognizing that that was a community that you wanted to be a part of, and that it was fruitful and you were getting something from it.
So it seems, at least from the outside, I don't live your life, you live your life, but it seems like you do a good job of both, which is that you are able to consistently commit to, you know, the groups that you want to be a regular attendee or member of, but then you also are constantly finding new things to check out and go see. And, you know, some of that is just one-off events, which are great too, but, you know, you just seem particularly tapped in. Like how does one become tapped into what's happening when it comes to community and events in the church?
I think the way to get tapped in is it's tough, right? Because we're talking about both the in-person and the digital. And so I think digitally, just join every WhatsApp group that's out there, right? Like, this is truly a way in which so many people are communicating, and you get to join the WhatsApp or the listserv, which I guess people don't use the listserv that much anymore, but you know, the email newsletter and all of these ways in which there's digital tools that let you know what's happening.
Just where are you finding them? Like, what, join them how?
And so that joining them how comes from when you decide to go to the young adult event at St. Patrick's, right? You show up and you just ask someone, right? And that takes a lot. That takes a lot for you to go up to a complete stranger and say, hey, I see this event just happened and I want to know more. Also, I recognize that sometimes our bulletins are not updated or they're not being put on their websites, right? That's a much larger issue that's happening throughout all our churches. But it's a matter of, if you open that bulletin or you hear the announcement and you want that, right? There's that desire within you. The spark is there to be involved, to know more, go up to a person. If you're at a church and at the end of Mass, there's an announcement and somebody says, I'm in the hospitality committee. If you want to join, come talk to me. I'll be in the vestibule. Go up to them, right? Like, actually go up to them, because I think a lot of the times we are in this era of, for example, social media, where it's instant gratification, right? We think that being on Facebook for our parish and seeing 20 reactions to a post means that everyone's on Facebook. No, 20 people are on Facebook. They reacted. When you look at the algorithm, when you look at the data, it's showing you that you think that people are reacting. Nothing will trump the in-person interaction, where not only does something happen chemically in your body when you meet the people and you get excited to meet other people and that connection happens, but also it's so much deeper than you just anonymously pressing a button on social media.
I love this idea that going to see the person who made the announcement after Mass is for the extroverts and bulletins are for the introverts, essentially. I shouldn't say that, but I'm kind of, you know, I never thought about that. Where, like, I, as someone doing digital marketing most of his career, looking at bulletins some often makes me sad. Like, why? How are we still stuck here? You know, but I guess maybe it is an important thing for people who are not ready to have a conversation. You know.
Yeah, you know, I don't think we can get away from bulletins at all, Dave. I know that there's always this idea that we can, but it seems to me that is such a very important touch point with people. I mean, and I, even with younger people, I mean, the students I teach, I don't think that they would ever kind of pass the opportunity to actually get something physical in their hands. I mean, I think that that's very much connected to everything we're saying about the importance of being physically present to each other. So this is another kind of extension of that. So I mean, you do have a relationship, of course, with your computer or with your phone. But the problem with that is that it's it covers everything and anything. It's not really focused on one thing. You can be using those devices to tap into anything that's part of your life that requires you to be engaged with that.
Yeah, that's right.
But the, you know, the bulletin has certain types of parameters. Like, this is only coming from this church, and that's all you can do with this is just be able to read this. And I think that that's kind of also what it is with people, right? I mean, what you see is what you get, and you enter into that. So
I think thinking about what a group or a community is for is so important to deciding that question about the end goal when it comes to the digital experience. What I mean is, you said something to Luisa Maria in that conversation. You said that, you know, the doing it something digital first and then meeting in person can create a lot of sophistication and lay some groundwork that isn't there if the people haven't gotten to know each other first. And that really resonated with me because I, once upon a time, was in a long distance relationship, and where I was doing the original online dating, where all you could do is have Skype conversations. And yes, it was Skype, and this was before whatever. And like that type of date, people hear that and like, they're like, oh, that must be so much worse than in-person dating. Well, at first, no, because actually, like, compare just being able to talk to bowling or a movie or whatever. Like, when you just talk and that's all you're doing for hours, and that's all you do for days or months or however long this thing goes, like, you really get to know a person. Talk about intimacy, right? Like, you get to know someone on a very deep level that doesn't usually happen in my experience with other types of with in-person dating. However, what's the point of that relationship, right? If there's no end in sight to the digital only, then you got to get out of there. And I've been there. And so I think asking that question, like, what is this for? You know, this ongoing book club that I mentioned, like, the in-person, you know, meetings can be cool, but that's not why we're in it. We're in it to kind of have this ongoing journey together that really does develop. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned this. I get to see all these people at my son's baptism coming up, you know, that I generally only see online, because we have legitimate friendships and, you know, we know each other's lives. It can be very deep over years.
Maybe the thing is that the virtual component is very task oriented. Like, we're doing this for specific tasks. It's like setting up a Zoom call for a meeting. Like, oh, at this meeting, we're going to do these things. And then the in-person encounters are maybe less task motivated. It's more about the celebrating the experience of just being in each other's presence. So I think that, you know, maybe we can be okay with, you know, a virtual space providing a certain type of need that is maybe not done very well in person all the time. Maybe it can get certain things done better. It doesn't mean to say that you can't do quote unquote productive things in person. Of course you can. I think that it's here to stay, right? So we have to just be able to kind of discern this relationship.
As someone who works remotely almost all the time, you know, I thought going into this, I couldn't wait to kind of like stop having inane like kind of interruptions to my day when someone would just sort of like pop out of nowhere at my desk. And now I got to tell you, I really kind of miss those moments. Not with everyone.
Right. No.
But like, like when you work remotely, you don't have a conversation with someone unless it's planned. There's no like just happening upon something. You're right. There's always a purpose. There's always a task at hand when you're having these kind of planned meetings.
It's probably one of the reasons why you get upset when I'm late to something, because I'm like, well, I just met a real person outside and they made me late for this meeting.
And this is why, you know, this is why there's certain like new technologies, like, I guess it's not that new these days, but like Discord, for example, has been kind of interesting, because you can kind of just leave your chat room open. And if someone comes in, you can just chat, not necessarily any expectation. Of course, the fact that they're going into that room instead of another one means there is sort of still already some focus in some way. But
interesting. Yeah.
But you can think of it as a place where someone is rather than a reason for someone to gather. That is it for this episode of Religion to Reality. We hope you learned as much from these conversations as we did, and that maybe you're walking away with some new perspectives on community. Maybe you're thinking about the type of small group you're called to join or even start. Maybe you're just reconsidering what community is supposed to mean and how to be in community well, and what you might be missing in terms of the communities you're part of right now. Thanks again to our guests for this episode, Mark Heyman, Renee Roden, and Luisa Maria Hernandez. You can find Mark at thediabetespsychologist.com. Renee's work can be found at reneedarlineroden.com. That's reneedarlineroden.com. And Luisa Maria's website is Luisa Maria, L-U-I-S-A, M-A-R-I-A, Hernandez with a Z.com. You can find out more about them in our show notes. Please join us again next week, where we're going to be talking about data from other studies to a look at the Synod on Synodality. Once again, I'm your host, Dave Plisky, joined by my friend and co-host, John Gribowich, and we hope to see you again next time. Religion to Reality is an initiative of DeSales Media created by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Connor Donnelly. If you found value in our conversation, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you love the show, ratings and reviews go a long way toward letting others know about the show. Go to religiontoreality.org for more details and resources. And if you are ready to take the next step and join in community with us, check out the Called Learning Community, co-founded by Father John Gribowich. Go to calledcommunity.com to sign up for our free online gatherings.